This is the fifth day of this January 2014 Rohatsu 7-day session. And we'll again return to the teachings of 20th century Zen, Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim, reading from book The Way of Korean Zen, edited by Stephen Batchelor. We were reading yesterday from a chapter called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. And this is the third of those discourses. Since the subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment has been present even before the creation of the earth, it has never been lost. Why do you say that you are looking for it again? From long ago until now, it has been unimpeded and has been shining brightly and tranquilly. Assembly gathered here today, have you completely awakened to it or not? If there is a monk endowed with a Dharma eye, let him say something. In reality, what is this subtle wisdom of complete enlightenment? Huck! Let me introduce you to a few words from a talk of Master Zongjing. He once said, "All sentient beings are covered by the six dusts." This means that they are covered by the six kinds of thieves that come from the outside. And now I'm going to refer back further back in the text to where he elaborates more on these six thieves. If you feel that you are not yet a Buddha, this means that the downfall of the six thieves is still to take place. All things in the external world that pass through the six sense doors are like thieves who are intent on cheating you. This, by the way, is a very common metaphor in Asian Buddhism, the six thieves. The first five are our ordinary senses. And then the sixth in Buddhism is considered the sense of thought, thinking. It's interesting that it's lumped in with seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, because like those senses, there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with hearing and seeing and smelling and tasting and touching. There's nothing wrong with thinking when it's called for. It's when we become attached to our thoughts, same as the sounds or tastes and so forth. It's when we can't leave them. It's when we insist on sifting through our thoughts that we miss reality. But it's considered one of the six senses, and then also one of the six thieves. So each one of them, he likens, he personifies them into thieves who are intent on cheating you. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. And as soon as you are deceived in even the slightest way by one of these thieves, it is equivalent to being killed by them. For at that moment, they take control of your mind. Because of them, intrinsic Buddhas are made to act like ordinary sentient beings. So in a real sense, when we are absent from this very presence, this moment of direct experience, when we are taken away by the corruption of these any of these six senses, then we're not fully alive. Our mind is adrift in some other world of dust that we call thoughts. They continuously deceive you and drag you here and there. So the important thing to understand is that just the direct experience of, let's say, hearing, just the sound of the train, let's say, the train going by, just that simple, clean, direct sound is not a problem. But we always are in danger of then weaving some kind of thoughts about the sound. And then in any number of ways, getting stuck in the past and losing the present. And of course the same with thoughts. Thoughts come through the mind. That doesn't need to be a problem. It's when we cling to them that we are not fully alive at that moment because we're somewhere else. He continues, in the face of these six thieves, you need the courage of a soldier on the front line fighting the enemy. When suddenly faced with an enemy in the midst of a battle, a soldier does not have the time to ponder whether his adversary can shoot well or not, or whether such a shot would be fatal. In order not to risk being killed by the enemy's fire, he is simply forced to shoot immediately. Similarly, as soon as the slightest thought appears in the doorway of one of the six senses, you should be as alarmed as though a thief were trying to break into your house. The moment one of the six thieves shows itself in the doorway of the senses, the koan investigation of the essential will have deserted you. Otherwise, how could one of the thieves have appeared in the first place? For as long as the koan is held firmly in mind, the six sense doors will be kept tightly closed, and there will be no gap through which a thief could enter. So it doesn't mean we become insensate, that we wouldn't hear a sound, but that there's nothing attached to that sound. It's just the direct experience of the sound, and it's gone immediately. Therefore, while the koan remains vivid, you remain alive. But as soon as one of the six thieves manages to enter the door of the senses, you are already dead. To change the analogy, it's we want in Zazen, we want to be aware, immediately aware of a thought, the appearance, the entrance of a thought, without being involved in the content of the thought. That's a very fine line. Just noticing a thought, but not even getting involved at all in what the content of the thought is. In a way, not even knowing what the content is. It occurred to me, it's sort of like you're about to cross a street, and out of the corner of your eye, you see a car speeding toward you. That's enough, just to see that it's speeding towards you. You don't need to note the make and model, the color, the license plate. Just get up, get back, leave it alone. This is the kind of intense vigilance that we can find ourselves able to manage late in session, when we're doing so much sitting, we have done so much sitting, that we can notice a thought and be done with it before it has a chance to draw us in. In order, he continues, in order to cause the downfall of the six thieves, you must cast aside all concern for the body. You should discard it as you would a useless stone that serves no purpose. Habitually, you blindly follow your uncontrolled attachment to the body and thus spend your entire lives trying to feed it and clothe it well, thereby making sure that it is comfortable. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been the servant of the body and have thus played the role of an ordinary sentient being. But from now on, you should learn to make it serve you. Likewise, instead of being captivated by the six senses, you should also make them obey you. Henceforth, it is you who must have the final word. In this way, your practice will be able to progress well. And then finally, it is a great mistake to think that after having practiced hard for a few days, you are then entitled to lie back and enjoy yourself for a while. This, by the way, is why in warm weather sessions, we will often announce that people are not to be out lying in the sun. Today would be a different matter. It is easy to find any number of pretexts for behaving in this manner, but to do so will cause you to be killed by the six thieves. Thus, you will be reduced to playing the role of a corpse. So the underlying point is that we're not fully alive when we're not present, when we're not living out of direct experience. To be living in our thoughts is some other kind of existence, some gray netherworld. And then he picks up again. Thus they are coming. This is all sentient beings covered by the six dusts. He was quoting this master Zongjing. And then he himself comments, thus they are coming and going along the path of birth and death. However, and then these are the words of Zongjing again, their original nature is never obscured. Original nature is never obscured. No matter how much we live in our thoughts, even there, our self nature, our bright self nature, is undiminished. And he elaborates on that. Therefore, if a poor, again he's quoting Zongjing, if a poor woman were in possession of a treasure, she would bury it so deeply that no one would be able to dig it up and take it away. And then he comments, but even if someone were to take it away, it would still remain the same. And if the poor woman kept it in her possession, it would also remain the same. This treasure will always stay just as it is. Moreover, even though a diamond is extracted from very deep within the earth, it cannot be destroyed. You should bear this in mind. The wisdom of your original nature is always clear and bright. It never changes. In a koan in the Blue Cliff Record, Zen Master Yunmen, or Ummon, begins the koan, there is one treasure hidden in the mountain of form. The world of form. What is that treasure? What is it? What is Mu? What am I? Who am I? These are all ways of searching, reaching for that treasure that is your own nature. Going to skip the rest of this third discourse because it's quite a bit of repetition. I think some repetition can be useful, and all of the teachings have employed repetition as a way to try to break through the hard case of the mind with these basic teachings. But I'm going to skip now to the fourth discourse. He begins, "Today is the last day of the lunar month. The new moon is so bright that its light pervades the entire Dharma Dhatu, all of existence." Notice there he says, the new moon is so bright. A new moon is a black moon. What does he mean? It doesn't matter what time of month it is, the moon is there. Whether it's illuminated or not is another thing, but it's always there in all of its fullness. Long ago, Master Nan Xuan once took his assembly of monks to look at the moon. "So, is this moon I am talking of the same as or different from the moon that Master Nan Xuan gazed at? Those of you monks who are endowed with a Dharma eye, say something." "Assembly of monks, it is true that these days you are exerting much effort in your practice of meditation. However, I would like to add a few words for your benefit. Of the 90 days of this winter retreat, already half have passed, for today we have reached the midpoint of the meditation season, and only 45 days are now left. Every day, time flows on urgently like water. Even though it may seem that there are certain enjoyments in life, actually, we are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away." That's one of my very favorite analogies. We are just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. "Likewise, not only you monks gathered here, but all sentient beings are traveling the path that only leads to death. As each day passes, your lifespan decreases by one day, and as each hour passes, it decreases by 1 hour. Just listen to this clock. With every tick, the second hand moves, pauses, and moves on again. This itself can immediately be taken as a Dharma lecture of the Buddha. Therefore, the demon of transiency is propelling us toward death every moment. I found a couple of stories this morning. That express the same predicament, the human predicament of the only creature that knows of its own mortality. This is a famous one that a lot of you have heard, a parable told by the Buddha about a person traveling across a field who encountered a tiger. He fled, the tiger came after him, he came to a precipice, a cliff, and he caught hold of the root of a wild vine and swung himself down over the edge. The tiger sniffed at him from above. The man looked down, far below, another tiger was waiting to eat him. Only the vine sustained him. Two mice, one white and one black, little by little started to gnaw away the vine. The man saw a luscious strawberry near him. Grasping the vine with one hand, he plucked the strawberry with the other. How sweet it tasted! One way to understand this is that it is really only by being aware of the fragility of life, the preciousness of life, the impermanence, that we can truly appreciate, truly value life, each moment. Some people find this talk about the fleeting nature of life as morbid. It's realistic. These masters are trying to wake us up from our slumber, our denial of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. There's a very short story. I'll just read it. In the last century, a tourist from the United States visited the famous Polish rabbi Chafetz Chaim. He was astonished to see that the rabbi's home was only a simple room filled with books. The only furniture was a table and a bench. The tourist asked, "Rabbi, where is your furniture?" And the rabbi said, "Where is yours?" And the visitor said, "Mine, but I'm only a visitor here." "So am I," said the rabbi. These are not just idle kind of melancholy reflections on the state of the human predicament. It's all, what he's doing is trying to mobilize the aspiration of the monks to get their motivation going to use this time while we have it, to take advantage of this extraordinary privilege of having come into contact with the Dharma, to use the time, whatever time is left to us. He continues, let us hear him out. "If you do not realize the truth of the unborn, then when the time of death suddenly arrives, you will find yourself moaning in illness. Even though nobody wants to die, every one of us will inevitably perish. Is there anyone here among you whose body is not a potential corpse? If there is, then speak out. Furthermore, should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? Or would it be better to live in order to awaken to the truth of the unborn? When you are finally moaning an illness, then you may have regrets at not having diligently practiced while alive. But at that time, such regrets will be in vain. Therefore, why do you not practice now? Why do you just continue to play around? There is a poignancy, isn't there, to the human condition, to the ordinary person's denial of death and carrying on wasting time as if going to live forever. One other source to read here. Again, this is by Matthew Arnold, whose words I read yesterday. This is the beginning of a long poem, a prose poem. And I'm just going to read the first dozen or so lines. What is the course of the life of mortal men on the earth? Most men eddy about here and there, eat and drink, chatter, love, and hate, gather and squander, are raised aloft, are hurled in the dust, strive blindly, achieving nothing. And then they die, perish. And no one asks who or what they have been, more than he asks what waves in the moonlit solitudes mild of the midmost ocean have swelled, foamed for a moment, and gone. Already there are people who sat in this zendo who have died. Which of us will be next? Keep your koan bright and do not let it darken. Everything else can be left aside, but the koan should be considered as your own life. You must try to investigate it like an old mouse entering a cow horn. In some countries, when people want to catch a mouse, they will put some fragrant oil in the pointed end of a horn and place it near the mouse's hole. The mouse is attracted by the smell, and once it thinks it is safe, crawls into the horn. It gets nearer and nearer the oil until finally its body gets stuck in the pointed end and it is unable to withdraw. In order to taste the oil, the foolish mouse has no fear of death and without any hesitation crawls right to the end of the horn. When even a mouse can be as brave as this in order to get what it desires, shouldn't human beings put forth a similar determination of mind in order to resolve the great matter of birth and death and to realize the great truth of the universe? Shouldn't human beings cease to be preoccupied with this body and one time exert themselves in order to awaken? I'm reminded of the distinction between the the desire of the monk to get the oil and the desire to awaken for the sake of all beings. The two different words in the Pali, the original language of the Buddha, the word tana means craving or thirst, and this is what is drawing the mouse in deep into that horn, is the craving to get something, whereas the desire to awaken for the sake of all beings is the desire to do something and for the sake of others. This is the Pali word is chanda. Because this is a question that comes up at workshops quite often, where someone will ask, you know, you say that we want to become free of our desires, which is a little misreading of it. We want to get free of our attachment to our desires. Of course we desire warmth and food and sex and sleep, but our attachment to them, this is what we emphasize in Zen. But they say, well, you say you want to get usually they mangle it by saying we want to get rid of our desires, and then they say, but what about the desire for enlightenment? Well, it's not the same, is it? Not to mention the fact that as long as one has even that exalted desire, the desire to awaken for the sake of all beings in the mind, one will be denied it. This is the purpose of the practice, to get our mind off of a goal that we think we want to get for ourselves. And so forget ourselves and our desires that we become free of them. As an aspiration, as an underlying aspiration, this what they call bodhicitta, the desire to awaken for the sake of all beings, this isn't going anywhere. We don't have to think about that desire. That's what brought us here. But then to dwell on the thought of crossing some finish line, or however one imagines it, this then just becomes a big obstruction, a hindrance. He continues, you should practice with the same urgency as a person with a parched throat thinking of water. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. At that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. At such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. Now your practice may actually seem easy, but you should be most careful, since this is a very crucial moment. So we can reach a point where the koan grips us so much that it's like the koan is working on us. This is a very promising state, because it's just like we're being swept downstream. But even here, there's the danger of getting cast off into the weeds if we aren't vigilant. At this time, you will automatically forget to even sleep or eat. To not let this opportunity slip by requires true wisdom. So do not waste it. Be as resolute as the Buddha when he sat for 7 days uninterruptedly. you forget to even sleep or eat. This is a state, a very advanced state of absorption. And it lifts one's efforts beyond effort. Where is the effort when you forget to sleep or eat? You're being carried by something immense, profound. Until reaching this point, then the idea of going without sleep, going without food, can seem so remotely difficult, almost impossible. But that's because you're thinking about it. Last year, at a sesshin, someone passed Mu on the last day, the last Doksan period, the very last Doksan, last person to go to Doksan. And that person had gone without sleep for a long time. He told me that he woke up in the middle of the night on Thursday night and didn't sleep again until he passed Mu. My guess is that he didn't see it as some Herculean effort, because he was in the grip of the koan. He had to know what it is. I can already imagine people hearing something like this and thinking, oh great, that's that, when am I ever, I'm as close to that as I am to the moon. But it can change very quickly. It really can. Just like that. One moment, you seem so hard, you're struggling, trying to stay, and then grace, if we may use that word, grace intervenes, something magical happens, and now it's a whole different story. This is, I think you don't want to conclude from this that if you go without sleep for a long time, that's going to get you there. It won't necessarily. Each person has to determine how much sleep she or he needs. It's different for different people. And now Kusan Sunim addresses a different level of practice, the level of non-doing, which we mentioned yesterday, Wu Wei. When deluded people look inside themselves, they will find there are things to be cultivated and to be gained. Therefore, they make a great effort to practice. But as soon as they have completed what they set out to do, they realize that there was nothing really to have been done. Thus, the true Dharma involves non-doing. All things that are done will finally cease. Thus, the Dharma of doing is the false Dharma. But everything that you do, which in reality is non-doing, constitutes eternal truth. Such actions will not cease even though you attempt to be finished with them. This is the truth of the unborn and undestroyed. So, the way to, I think, to understand this in terms of practice is that with the help of the practice, the koan or the breath practice, we actually are, we find a way to get out of the way of doing, and we allow the practice to do the work. That's the difference between me doing this thing, this big project that I have to do, between that and just allowing it to be done, surrendering to the practice and letting it just unfold. And there's no one doing it. The practice transforms doing into non-doing by taking the self out of it. To the degree that you're absorbed in your practice, to that degree, there'll be no self behind it. No I, no me, no my. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to realize there is really nothing we need to do. This is not some burden that lies before us, like some terrible project, a task we have to do. We just have to trust the practice and the practice alone. Trust it. It will carry us. It will purify the mind so there's no I left to do anything. And then we just come into harmony with the Tao, with the Dharma. We'll now stop and recite the four vows.